Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Sylvia Earle, who is the president of the Sea Alliance, founder of Mission Blue, and explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. She is the 2011 Hitchcock Lecturer at Berkeley. Ms. Earle, welcome. Dr. Earle, welcome to Berkeley.
Great to be here.
Was it inevitable that you would pursue a degree in science once you went to college and university?
I think the pattern was set when I was 5 years old. Or maybe sooner. Maybe it was that wave that did it.
and what did you do your dissertation on?
The marine algae in the Gulf of Mexico, mostly one big group, the brown algae. And that was preceded by working on the division of green algae in the eastern Gulf of Mexico. So I was just working my way through that whole suite of photosynthetic creatures in the sea.
And who was your greatest inspiration as a graduate student?
Well, that's easy. That was Harold Hum. He taught a class in marine biology at Florida State University in the summer months, and I was fortunate to be one of the students in a class of eight during the second class that he taught. It was 1953 at the Alligator Harbor Marine Laboratory. We lived at the laboratory. So 24 hours a day for 8 weeks, we just soaked it up. That's where I first had a chance to try scuba. OSHA would not approve, but OSHA didn't exist at the time. And so we were just free to do a lot of things that today students are constrained from doing without a lot of rigmarole. But we were allowed to drive boats, to jump in the water, to try out diving equipment that was new. We had two of the first scuba tanks in the country, 1953, big double hose regulators, and instruction was very simple. Breathe naturally, and then we were dumped over the side. And it worked. We didn't die. We came back just, I did, all of us did, totally hooked on ocean exploration.
If one looks at your career, it's very interesting how the evolution came about. You start as a research scientist, you become an explorer, you become somebody who runs a technology company. What is the key here? Is it this wanting to learn and uncovering one problem after another, which sort of leads you into an additional career path?
Yeah, I think that's true with everyone. You start out a blank sheet and things come into your brain, and if you really are receptive, there are no holds barred. You can, in a free country, fortunately, I happened in a free country, where options are there for you to take, whether you're tall, short, young, old, male, female, whatever your skin color, there are the limits are mainly imposed by what you think you can or can't do. I mean, yes, there's some serious limitations. You don't have resources, but again, free country, you can figure out the ways and means to solve problems. And I think I took seriously that word commencement. Eighth grade, okay, commencement. Now it begins. Now the next step begins. You go to high school. There's another commencement, and you begin again. And then there's college, and there's another commencement. And so it just keeps rolling forward. And I think Goethe said it. It's not enough to know. You must also act. So knowing is critical. And when you think you've done it all, I got through high school. Yahoo! But that really should just be the beginning. You've got the tools to learn how to learn and keep learning and keep doing. So that's how it is. I wish I could live 1,000 years.
So in a way, it's after the safe landing, it's time to take off again.
Yes. Oh, yes, armed with the new stuff that you've acquired.
If we look at your many careers, and let's start as a research scientist, what do you see as both the skill set, the minimal skill set required, and also what qualities of character? We've obviously discussed some of the second part of that equation, but what can you tell us looking back at your career? Skill set.
I think having an open mind is critical. I think as a scientist, you're obliged to observe carefully and report honestly what you see. I think increasingly there should be an obligation to communicate as widely as possible, not just to your learned colleagues, but to anybody you can get to listen. Part of the reason I think that science is underappreciated in the United States and maybe in the world is because scientists have this lofty attitude, some do, not all, but it is sort of comes with the territory. I experienced it when I was involved with the Tektite project in 1970. I really took that opportunity on as a scientist. There was a notice on the bulletin board saying that there was an opportunity to live underwater as a scientist, to conduct research of your own choosing. All you had to do was submit a proposal, you might be chosen, to live 2 weeks on a coral reef down in the Florida Keys, all expenses paid. You weren't paid to do it, but you could be supported to do this wonderful thing.
And this was in 1970, right?
It was actually 1969.
69.
The project took place in 1970, and four researchers were chosen in 1969, more or less as human guinea pigs, to prove that you could live underwater. They actually stayed for 2 months underwater, and they were subjected to all sorts of medical tests. And they did do research projects, but that wasn't the major point. The major point was that they were the research project to see how they behaved, how they reacted physiologically, psychologically, and otherwise. Part of this was of interest to NASA because people had not then lived in space. There were certainly no women astronauts. And the space sky lab and the space station was still out there in the future. But they were very interested in how humans would behave in isolation.
And at this time, there were, for this government-funded proposal, there were a number of applicants, mm-hmm. and the government didn't know what to do with a project that had men and women. What was their solution?
They didn't expect women to apply. Mm-hmm. They didn't even bother to say, women, this is for men only. And there were no women astronauts. It just didn't occur to them to say, only men, this is only for men. And when some women did apply, I was one of them, and the qualifications as scientists, as divers, was right up there with the men who applied. The decision came down to, well, shall we allow women or not? And the head of the program, Dr. James Miller, I think he had a good relationship with his wife. I think he had a really good mom. Because when it finally came to him to decide, he said, well, half the fish are female. I guess we could put up with a few women. He actually allegedly said that. That's the story that comes down anyway. But so they let us participate, and then came the other question, men and women living together. And the phrase that I heard, and this is true, I did hear it, they were worried about hanky-panky on the reef. Men and women living together in close quarters.
Getting ideas from the fish.
Yeah, right, exactly. And this was 1970. So attitudes have changed a lot. Young women today, really, at least in the United States, cannot appreciate how exceptional it was at the time. And it's because of the exceptional nature of having not just women participate, but a women's team. All women. That's what they decided to do, to have five women, and I got to be the leader of it, to put the spotlight on the... And I think the program as a whole really took advantage of the fact that the press was interested, and we became the spokesmen, spokeswomen, spokespersons for the project in a way. So although there are 50 people involved with the Tech Type program, the women's team got a disproportionate amount of the attention. I have a book this thick of the clippings from all over the world. We had a ticker tape parade down State Street. We got to ride in the car that was especially built for the Pope when he went to Chicago years before, fur-lined, and with Mayor Daley, and it opened, ticker tape parade. I mean, imagine, for divers, for scientists, it was just extraordinary.
I have a question that comes to mind as I traced your career, and it is the following. What do you, in retrospect, see women bringing to the table in terms of insights, way of acting as you deal with the oceans, that actually draws on their strengths and their differences?
Well, for a while, I was annoyed at the thought that there are differences. I wanted to be regarded as a scientist, first and foremost, pure and simple. It's my mind, you fools, that matters. It's what I can do. And I said, and Life magazine quoted me as saying, the only thing that men can do down there that women can't is grow beards. Well, it isn't quite like that. But there is something to the... I mean, there's a whole spectrum, a continuum of capacity for strength, for the physical characteristics that set women apart, men and women apart. But I think there are some attributes that are special to women and attributes that are special to men. I don't think that it has anything to do with mathematical capability, or whatever some have managed to inject into our society is men can do this and women can't. Men are better managers, women than women. There is something I think about women with families, having children, the investment that women make with their own bodies to create the next generation, less inclined to see young people go off to become cannon fodder for war, because you appreciate what it takes to make a child, appreciate that special nature of family. They say educate a man, you educate a man. You educate a woman, you educate a family. There's something about the giving nature that comes with being put in that role of you have to be attentive for 9 months, more or less. Plus, you're the principal caregiver at the early stages, just because it's the nature of nature to be that. And that probably has something to do with shaping the way women behave, even if you aren't a mother, or even if you... And it isn't unique to women. I'm totally conscious of their really caring, invested men as well. But there is something about the role that women are necessarily put into as the primary caregivers at the earliest stages of being moms.
You're down in the water. You're living there. And one gets a sense in what you've written about this that there is kind of an awakening of insight. That you're... Talk about that. You're in a neighborhood, and you're watching the fish and the plants, and you're sort of able to identify individuality.
I had a chance to do two programs with Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers, diving down in the Florida Keys. I only took a day with Fred Rogers. He was predisposed to see the things in this special way. But after we came back from a day of swimming around looking at angelfish and groupers and snappers and little damselfish, we were having dinner. We were both Fred Rogers and I were a little bit late coming to dinner. And all the film crew and the others involved with this project from the sanctuary program and all the rest were busily having dinner, and most of them were eating fish. And in his Fred Rogers kind of way, he just went around from person to person saying, and this was just as nice as could be, I just can't believe that you're having fish after what we've been doing today. We were in the fish's neighborhood, as you say, and we were looking at individuals. And I guess I did point out to him that every angelfish was different. Everyone has a different face. And I first came to really appreciate that living underwater during the Tektite project in 1970. I'd been diving all over the place for years before that. Starting in 53, I had at least 1,000 hours already acquired by 1970. So I should have seen what finally came into focus when day and night I got to see the same fish in that same area, but everyone behaved a little bit differently from their other members of the same species. So I began to pick up on this, realizing that it's not just every fish. We see it with people. It's staggering to think that every human who's ever been or ever will be is different from every other one, even identical twins or triplets or whatever. That every cat, every dog, every horse, every cow, every zebra, you look at a whole herd of zebras, at first glance they all kind of look alike, but you really line them up, no two has stripes on their faces or their bodies, and they don't behave the same either. That's a staggering thought. But the equally staggering thought is how much we have in common. Zebras, humans, jellyfish, pine trees, ferns, whatever it is, the chemistry of life that holds us together is remarkably similar. And that to me, the two big miracles of life.
You had, at one point, you're quoted as having said, well, oh, that's the fish that lives
there.
At the rock, or yeah. Over there, basically. and it's striking that because most of us don't go into the ocean,
yeah.
we can't experience the totality and the qualities of these creatures.
Well, a lot of fish, curiously, well, not so curiously, it's what I would expect knowing what I now know, a lot of crustaceans, a lot of creatures on the land and in the sea are homebodies, and they have a specific range. They may leave, but they come back. They come back to the same place repeatedly. That's even true of tunas that range over thousands of miles in the course of a single year. They come back to the same places. Turtles may go away for 10 years, but they come back to the same nesting beaches from the same places where they hatched as little turtles. So the home range that really counts is this little blue speck in the universe. This is our home. And we range here and there over greater or lesser distances, but this is home for all of us.
To appreciate this in the ocean, you have to go into the ocean. Most people don't do that, and some would say, "Well, this is really courageous. Somebody like Sylvia Earle is a real risk taker." What's your answer to that? And if it's true that you have to have courage to do this, you know, how is that nurtured?
I don't think of it as taking risk. I think the biggest risk is not going. And if you don't like to get wet, or if you have problems with your ears or whatever, actually there are other ways than just diving. Submersibles are coming into their own. I expect there will be Hertz Rent-A-Sub one of these days, but already there are passenger submarines that enable you to buy a ticket and cruise down in the company of, you know, anybody who wants to go underwater, to go to 50 meters or so in Hawaii. in the Red Sea, in various places around the world, you can now do this. You can even go to, in a few places, to 1,000 feet, like the Cayman Islands has had an operation in place for years. You can buy a ticket, get into a little submarine, go down along a wall, see a cross-section of life on Earth right there, presented for you to enjoy. Or you can go to an aquarium, another way to get acquainted with life in the sea without getting wet. Aquariums are getting much better, so much better that I almost I have this vision of fish lining up outside to get inside the Monterey Aquarium, for example, because they make it so easy, so attractive for the creatures that they take care of. They think like fish. They think like barnacles. They think like, what does it take to keep a barnacle happy? And then they provide it.
But back when you went underwater, was it a lot riskier, or is it you just didn't think about it?
I didn't think of it as being risky. I thought of it as being a passport to something really wonderful and irresistible. My mother waited until she was 81 to actually put on a mask and fins, and in a beautiful place in Bonaire where the water is clear and warm and you could walk in from the beach. And once she had seen what was there, she'd been to aquariums and she'd seen lots of photographs, but that personal experience really made her cross with me. You know, why didn't you get me in the water sooner? And I thought I had tried, but I guess I didn't try hard enough. But I keep trying now with people and take her message out there. If you are 81, don't wait any longer. If you aren't yet 81, don't wait any longer. This is the time. We have opportunity to go.
In a way, it's a curiosity.
Yeah.
And then once you've been there, then the wonder of what you see. Then
it's
like, yeah. just one, you know, why not again? How many times, do you have a measure of how many underwater expeditions you've done?
Well, the time underwater is something in excess of 7,000 hours. The number of expeditions, well, lots and lots. I've been involved with more than 100. And an expedition is something more than just going out on a Saturday afternoon, although that can qualify depending on what it is. I mean, for example, I considered it an expedition to go with James Cameron in the Russian Mir sub to the bottom of Lake Baikal. Now, it was just a day, but it is a day that will stay with me forever because it was this great piece of machinery that enabled me to go with the great explorer, filmmaker, polymath, if you will, James Cameron, and the designer of the submersible itself, Anatoly Sagalovich, Russian engineer, spokesperson for the ocean, been to the North Pole, the real North Pole, that is 15,000 feet down at the bottom of the North Pole, the real North Pole. And this was just last year. So that was an expedition that I will treasure. But other expeditions can last for a week or 2 weeks or a month, whatever it is. But I've had the pleasure of putting together and participating in lots of adventures of that sort, not just waiting for somebody to invite me, although I'm always receptive when I can to participate, but the thing about, again, being a human, you don't have to wait to be asked. I suppose that's why I started those companies. I've started three. I was not happy with the equipment that exists, so why wait? Why not team up with engineers to start a company? I didn't know what I didn't know. Great education, launching yourself as a scientist into this world of being an entrepreneur and learning law, learning accounting, learning how to make payroll, learning how to balance the books. I mean, I guess a good start for me was being an ecologist, knowing that you have to balance the books. Nature always does. And as an entrepreneur, you have to do that too, even if it means mortgaging your house.
In looking and reflecting back on your career, one sees that there are several trajectories coming together. One is curiosity, you know, all that you got from your family. The other is the opportunities opening up for women.
Yeah.
But thirdly, it's really technology. So
you've
ridden the wave of technology. And in the beginning, you're a beneficiary of technology, but then you move into the realm of actually helping to create the technology. So you were talking about that just then, but what is navigating that like?
Well, it's the joy of being alive, I suppose, and being receptive to what's going on around you. Building new generations of submersibles to have access to the sea. It is so frustrating to know the magnitude of what we don't know about this blue speck in the universe. And to understand that part of the reason that people aren't just all over the place trying to get into the ocean is that they don't know. They don't see it. They don't see what I see. Don't grasp the significance of life in the sea and the need we have to protect it. First, we have to understand it. And while I've witnessed the big inroads that we're making into our life support system, altering the nature of nature, and we're doing it in ignorance, the big frustration of watching people really excited about going high in the sky, and I'm among them. I love that. Being able to look back and see Earth from space and to have the ability to fly all over the world and hone the technology to communicate in ways to be able to find your place on the planet. I've lived through the time when you couldn't get back to the same place underwater twice unless you were really lucky. Our ability to navigate, to find places in the sea, to be able to track a course and repeat that course over the surface, let alone under the ocean. These are all developments of the latter part of the 20th century, ironically driven largely by war, by conflict. We want to get the edge on the enemy. And it's true with aviation and aerospace as well, but and with military needs, the spillover into science and exploration is coming, but it's a little slow. Much better maps of the ocean in the secret places of the military than we have available to those of us who want to know the ocean for other reasons.
It's an interesting problem because what drives technology, if it's a military purpose, then that's different from driving technology and creating technology based on the needs of exploration, curiosity, knowing, and so on. And you actually, in starting this company, then began working with engineers and giving to them ideas about what you wanted to do. If you wanted to turn in the water or swim like a fish or whatever, that
to pick things up, without crushing them,
and so that hey, that's what we really need. And and what was that interface like with engineers? I mean, you really moved the technology along.
Well, part of it actually began in discussions with one of my favorite engineers ever, and that's Ed Link, who was first smitten with aviation. He developed the Link trainer that pilots owe their lives to. This was a way to train without actually going up in the sky and falling out of the sky, sometimes disastrously, but to have an on-the-ground replica of what the cockpit was like, to learn the motion through a simulator. That's what they flight simulators. And then he turned his attention to the sea and developed the Johnson Sea Link submersibles. And prior to that, working with Perry, John Perry, to develop a submarine that you could swim out of, a lockout submarine. This goes back to the 1960s, this great explosion of interest in living underwater, submersibles that could take people down. Anyway, I was invited to go on a Man in Sea. I think I was the only woman in the Man in Sea project in 1968 to try locking out of the little submarine called the Deep Diver. I was actually expecting my youngest daughter at that time, and she attributes her love of the ocean for saying, well, I locked out of a submarine before I was born, and so, of course, I had to naturally love the ocean. And anyway, so after the, so Ed Link wanted to know, okay, so I've got this wonderful machine, so what can I do with it? Give me some ideas about science projects that can be conducted from this wonderful gift to science. So he invented the tool and then said, how can we use this tool? So I was among those who had the great fun of figuring out, so we have this means of getting down to 1,000 feet beneath the surface and then swimming out of it. And as a diver, as a scientist, using the ocean as a laboratory. And then when the Johnson Sea Link, a pair of them, were developed, I again had a chance to be among the first to lock out of this beautiful new piece of equipment that has continued to operate until, and it's still operating, but unfortunately this country gave away, didn't give it away, but those assets, the two Johnson Sea Links, were sold to Petrobras, Brazilian oil company. So we don't really have that kind of asset in this country at this point in time. The Alvin submersible, which is, I've tried now about 30 different kinds of submersibles. I haven't yet tried the Alvin, although lots of scientists have. It's the workhorse of access to the sea down to the average depth of the ocean, 2.5 miles. The Alvin is currently out of commission, but it's getting refitted to be able to resume a new life with a new pressure hull and all the great assets that engineering and science together have developed over, you know, the last 40 years or so, 50 years.
What we need, it seems, is government investment in exploring this part of the world, but that hasn't come. So it's like there's a catch 22 here, that we can't appreciate the oceans and realize the damage we're doing unless we see, but we need the money to invest in the equipment to see. And so how do you account for the fact that the government has been willing to explore the stars, go into outer space, but it seems constrained in this greatest adventure, you know, here on Earth?
Well, there are a lot of possible answers to that. I had lunch once years ago with that great stateswoman and playwright, ambassador, lots of things, Claire Booth Luce, at her home in Hawaii. And I put the question to her, why is it that we are so drawn to aviation and aerospace, and why are we neglecting the ocean? What's going on here? And she said, it's simple, my dear, looking up at these puffy white clouds that were floating by. She said, heaven is there, and you know it's in the other direction. Mm-hmm. There's this mindset that good is up and bad is down. And I think there may be some psychological truth to that, but there's something more. Another really good friend, also in Hawaii, John Craven, who is another polymath, engineer, really skilled in law. He was involved with the Navy for many years, the dark side of the Navy that you can't talk about. Chief scientist for the Polaris missile program. He was the one working with Admiral Rickover about nuclear submarines and the force behind the NR-1, the Navy's research nuclear submarine. He has written a book trying to kind of apologize to the mostly men involved with the Navy who dedicated their lives to ocean exploration and the development of technologies that have made possible a great knowledge base about the sea, but they're not talking about it. It's all secret stuff. And it's sad that there are heroes that we can't celebrate the way we celebrate the astronauts because they're behind closed doors. It's some of the benefits, think of the many technologies that we now have for navigation, so much surveillance, and it's a combination of what's up in the sky and what's under the sea. This whole network, the listening stations that we didn't know about for years that were developed to listen for enemy submarines. Now they have enabled scientists to track whales, to understand the importance of sound in the sea, that we scientists would not have the budget to put the billions of dollars into this listening station so we can tune in to the little tweaks that submarines make or ships on the surface too. But that investment has been made, just as much of the investment in satellites is not for domestic benefits, but for military purposes. But everyone has been the beneficiary of the investment made for security reasons. But not all of the benefits have been made known. There's still this treasure chest of wonderful new insight about technologies that we don't yet have access to. So, what do? We tap into the private resources that are there. So you've got Jim Cameron now taking what he has earned as a filmmaker, as an entrepreneur, as a businessman. Richard Branson, same thing, using his wealth to invest in pushing the edge of new technologies, pulling from things that have come to us from those who have invested from the past, but pulling it all together and not being afraid to commit to looking where nations, governments, taxpayers are not making the investment, individuals are. And eventually we will see nations catching on. In fact, they are. I mean, China is building a 7,000-meter Sea Dragon sub to go deeper than anybody else now can go in the sea. India is developing a 6,000-meter sub. Russia has three. The United States has exactly zero. We aren't making that investment. But the entrepreneurs, the businessmen, the visionaries are using their personal wealth to fill the gap. And that's, in a very small, modest sense, is what I tried to do in starting Deep Ocean Engineering, Deep Ocean Technology, and then finally the company that now still exists. It's Deep Ocean Exploration and Research, DOER Marine Operations, that I no longer have anything to do with, but my daughter and son-in-law own and operate and are continuing in that same spirit, that same mode of trying to make a difference while at the same time making a living.
It would seem then that if we're concerned about global governance of the oceans, which because of the things that we're doing to the ocean in the way of taking out and putting in bad stuff, the key is going to be some sort of governance that
has
nations agree.
So do
you have any thoughts about how this dynamic is going to work? In one sense, national security is denying us...
And international security.
Yeah, are denying us the opportunities of the sea.
Right.
But we have to understand the sea for the public education to really have a kind of global insights in the way you have developed them as an individual and as a scientist. So there's a conundrum here.
There is.
And what you've committed yourself to public education, to awakening people to the set of problems that relate to the ocean. What should we be doing and working toward to make the kind of changes that seem necessary?
I personally am driven by an awareness that nature matters, that our lives depend on maintaining the integrity of the planet that works in our favor. All preceding history, 4.5 billion years, Earth was not hospitable for us until fairly recent times, geologically speaking. Go back 1 billion years, there's lots of water on the planet and lots of life, but Earth wouldn't be suitable to support us. It's amazing that we, in a very short period of time, have kind of reversed that trend, this long history, a planet that works in our favor. And now, in a few decades, we're making it work in a way that's not in our favor. What are we thinking? This is the first time in history, first time. Didn't know, even in the middle of the 20th century, what we now know. The capacity to hold the world in our hands, to see that nature matters, that what we're doing to the atmosphere, what we're doing to the fabric of life, what we're doing to the systems that generate the oxygen that we count on, the systems that we count on to grab the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, the systems that hold the planet steady, that the chemistry of the planet depends in the end on each and every little microbe, every elephant, every whale, every raccoon, every human, whatever it is, that we all have an influence on the world around us. But there's one species that has just kind of run away with things and altering the way the world works and happening in a very short period of time. And it's knowing that drives me to do everything I can in every way that I can, education, call that communication, whatever it is, to get people to see it for themselves. It's not a big deal. We're not making this up. Information is accessible now for the first time to the world, anywhere in the world. You can, thanks to Google, another technology that I have embraced with my whole heart, mm-hmm. Along with a companion technology, this company called ESRI, E-S-R-I, where you take data from here. It's looking at the world as an ecologist with layers of information. And then you step back and you see, okay, how does the water affect where the trees are, where the people are? And if you want to put a factory or a school or a community, well, first let's look at how the world works. Where does the water flow? Where are other people? Where are the transportation lines? What impact does that have on the downstream? Anyway, now we know. And now we can look at the world with new eyes. In 2006, which wasn't that long ago, I attended a conference in Spain. The person who had much to do with the development of Google Earth, in fact, its predecessor called Keyhole, John Hanke. The company Keyhole was acquired by Google and became Google Earth. I downloaded Keyhole to my computer when it existed like that, paid my $600 to do it, and then I paid my second round of $600 when Google wasn't free, now it is, so that I could do this wonderful thing. Look at my computer screen. Now you can look at your cell phone, and there it is, Google Earth. But until 2009, you couldn't look under the ocean. It took 3 years. I met John Hanke in 2006 at this conference in Spain. I had a chance to say why the ocean matters in 15 minutes. John Hanke had a chance to talk about Google and Google Earth. And when I saw him sitting in the front row, I just couldn't resist. I said how much I love Google Earth and how my kids love it, my grandkids love it. But I just said, I hope someday, John, you'll finish it, because you've done a great job with the land, but you should call it Google Dirt. I think it's that word that I use that really got to John. And I said, the ocean, the blue part, it's missing. Later we talked, and he said, well, you're right. Something is missing, like most of the world. Can you come down to the Googleplex, talk to the Googlers, and see what we can do? And what followed was 3 years of advisory group of scientists, about 30 from around the world, conversations with the Navy to see how much data could be pried loose that would be publicly available to populate Google Earth with a map. It starts with a map. And National Geographic, we put out an atlas the same year that Google Ocean, or the Ocean and Google Earth, was launched in February of 2009. It was a really exciting time.
Tell us about what you're trying to do with your TED grant and build a network of reserves in the ocean.
Well, 2009, February, that same time that the Atlas, the National Geographic Ocean Atlas came out and Google launched the ocean in Google Earth, that week I was given a chance by TED, Technology, Entertainment, Design, this amazing collection of sort of a brain trust of individuals who started in Silicon Valley in Monterey. It's been more than 25 years now. They hold this annual conference to give individuals a chance to give the talk of their life. And when I had a call from Chris Anderson, who looks after TED, I thought at first my heart leaped. I'm going to be given a chance to give the talk of my life. And I was, but there was more, that I was being given a wish that had to be big enough to change the world. And my wish, after some deliberation, not much because it's what I've always been, well, since I, for a long time, most of my life, I guess, wanting to protect the ocean any way we could, or the land too, you know, nature. But most of it's underwater. Most of it is the sea. It's where 97% of the biosphere is. It's being seriously neglected and seriously affected by our actions. So my wish was to ignite public support, to develop new technologies, to explore the ocean, but most importantly to protect the ocean with any means that we could muster, resulting in networks of protected areas. On the land, about 12% of the land is invested in national parks, reserves, places that serve as an insurance policy against the losses that we're now seeing all over the planet. But the ocean, we've only got a fraction of 1% that is truly protected, about 1% that has some form of management with an eye toward protection. But when people say, well, okay, how much of the ocean do we need to protect? And I respond by saying, think of the ocean as the blue heart of the planet. How much of your heart do you want to protect? In effect, we have to get serious about protecting all of it, because the ocean governs the way the world works. And we can certainly start by identifying the most critical areas. Where do fish spawn? Where are the corridors over which these migration routes? Barbara Block at Stanford has been working now for years trying to figure out with her students, where are these patterns, the routes that tuna and swordfish and turtles and big elephant seals and other creatures travel? They do come back to the same place time and time again, but they travel widely, thousands of miles. Great white sharks travel across the entire Pacific Ocean from California to Japan and back again to the Farallon Islands. And we know their faces. We know their names, or we've given them names. They may have names that they give themselves, but certainly we've come to recognize individuals. And so how do we protect them? It starts with knowing, and information such as Barbara Block and her colleagues have been amassing. We know where to avoid. There are these highways in the ocean that if we know that this is where the whales go, we can avoid the central headquarters for where they pass through, or be cautious when we cross these animal shipping lanes, if you will. It's really important. If we care, and we should be caring, because our lives are linked to the same processes that matter to the creatures in the sea.
And is there a hope that governments will accept these designations, or that people will learn about them and then lobby their governments?
Both. It takes governments to protect the ocean, because you can own a chunk of land, in quotes. We have as we live our lives as individuals, we can take title and have responsibility for a chunk of land. But in the ocean, individuals, at least in our country and most countries, in some countries, actually, island countries do, communities and even individuals have a say, at least over some aspects of the adjacent ocean. But most nations now have jurisdiction out 200 miles. So it's necessary to inspire nations to do what has been done for the land, to accept responsibility, not just to give away the assets, fishing rights. Go strip the ocean of the life that's out there and take, as if it's free, which it's not, extract the systems, oil, gas, minerals, fish, lobsters, shrimp, whatever. We have had an attitude that it's free, that it's available. Even without a license, we have extracted wildlife from the sea to the point that we have lowered the level of many of the creatures that we do like to market for commodities, either as food or as goods that we use, oil or fertilizer or whatever, the way we used to with whales. Who ever thought that whales were owned by anybody? They're just there up for grabs. In the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, we stripped the ocean of whales and other large marine mammals, thinking of them primarily as goods, not as something of value as living creatures. Right up through much of the 20th century, right up until the 1972 in Richmond, a whaling station that took humpback whales. A lot of people today can't imagine a time when Californians killed whales for as commodities, mostly for animal food, dog food and cat food and the like, and fertilizer. New Zealand killed humpback whales. I visited the last whaling station there in 1978. They had just closed it. And South Africa, too, involved. Australia. I visited the last whaling station in Australia in 1978. They were killing sperm whales. I saw six young male sperm whales brought in and leveled down to chunks of meat and oil in a matter of hours. It took maybe 20 years to get those whales to the point where they were just pounds of meat to be used as commodities. Well, Australia is among the fiercest defenders of whales alive today, and so is New Zealand. The United States still allows some of the native Alaskans to take whales, bowheads, and a few gray whales, but by and large, we're not killing whales as a matter of policy, as a matter of principle. In part because it doesn't make any sense financially to do this anymore, and maybe it never did, to send ships all the way from Nantucket to the southern hemisphere. How do you make a viable economic model out of that? To bring back a few barrels of oil and you sacrifice lives? But for a while, there was demand for whale oil to illuminate our societies. But we have made the transition to other forms of energy that now we know that maybe these aren't working either for other reasons.
One last question. Reflecting on your life, you've made this transition from research scientist now to an activist. Is there a lesson that one can distill from your life experiences that would be a nugget of advice for students?
I haven't made any transition, not at all. I am a scientist, first and foremost. I observe carefully. I try to report honestly what I observe. The audience has just gotten bigger. I used to communicate largely with my learned colleagues. It was the National Geographic who probably kicked me out of my complacency in 1970. That plus being forced to speak in a way that I was most uncomfortable with in 1970 as a straight arrow, ivory-towered scientist at Harvard. imbued with the attitude that if you communicate to the public, if you write an article even for the National Geographic, you've crossed the line. You're a popularizer. And never look back, because you aren't welcome anymore as part of the club, those who are respected as scientists. It's a phenomenon that I think is largely passing, that now scientists are encouraged, not required, but encouraged to communicate with the public. But it was National Geographic, it was a tech type project, but it was also reading a book that was on my shelf, lurking there for years, that I hadn't really taken it in the light that I did in 1970 when the Geographic asked if I'd write an article for them, and I first said no. And then Thomas Huxley spoke to me from more than 100 years before in the book called On Discourses, Biological and Geological, a collection of essays based on lectures that he had given as a scientist. And the first essay was on a piece of chalk that he delivered to the Carpenters Union in Norwich, England. And he talked about the history of the North Atlantic Ocean written in the piece of chalk, like the chalk in the back pocket that carpenters carried around to make a line before they hammered nails or whatever. And in the introduction to that book, he spoke to my problem of the moment. He said, "Your fellow scientists will scorn you if you speak to the public, but you must do it, and you must tell the truth. Don't embellish. Don't stretch the truth because you think it makes a better story. The best story is the truth. It is. It's the most exciting story of all." So that's where I don't think of myself as an activist. I think of myself as a scientist who will convey to the best of my ability the view of what I see, and to encourage others to go see for themselves, because we are in a race to take the knowledge that we have acquired through all preceding history and this pivotal time that we now share. I tell kids they're the luckiest ever to come on the planet, because for the first time we know what we know, and it's the last best time we'll ever have to do something about using that the power of knowledge to take care of the natural world, nature, that takes care of us. We're in trouble. We're in trouble because of what we're doing to the atmosphere, to the ocean, to the fabric of life. And it was one thing to do it in ignorance. That's all preceding history. But now we know. So to sit on that knowledge and not do what you can while you can, so that in the future you will be respected for taking action. And if that's being an activist, then so be it. But why would you want to be anything else? If you know something, you see the train heading over the cliff and you're just watching it happen? Or you're doing everything you can to say, "Hey, conductor, hey, you people on the train, do something while we have a chance."
On that note, Dr. Earle, thank you very much for sharing your life experiences with us today.
It's a start.
Yeah,
I hope I still have some more time.
Good. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.